and you're listening to 91 FM. We have a very special guest with me now, Tom Shales, who has been National Public Radio's film critic for the past 6 years, and he's also the television critic and TV editor for The Washington Post. His column is syndicated to close to 150 papers. In Philadelphia, he's carried in the Daily News. A collection of his TV reviews has just been published. The book is called On the Air, and it contains reviews from 1974 to 1982. On the Air by Tom Shales is published by Summit Books. And in case you haven't heard Tom Shales on National Public Radio or read any of his writing, I should tell you that he's an excellent writer and also very funny. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Did you grow up watching a lot of TV?
Yeah, well, if I grew up, I grew up watching a lot of TV, yes.
Did you have limitations, daytime but not nighttime? Or?
No, you know, this was in the 50s, and nobody really thought of television as the blood-sucking monster that they think of it as now, or the brain-draining monster. So my parents were just delighted to have this thing in the house that kept us quiet and kept us entertained. Of course, a lot of parents, I think, still use television that way. But we weren't placed in front of it and told to shut up. I don't mean to imply that. We just were allowed to watch whatever we wanted. And, of course, much of it was marvelous then and terribly imaginative. You know, I have a piece in the book about a kiddie show I used to watch, which enchanted us when we were kids, partly because it was so primitive that it did stir our imaginations. They just didn't have a budget on the show for any scenery or props or anything. So the man would just sit there and talk to the camera, and he'd pretend to be in a car, or he'd pretend to be, I don't know, at the North Pole, whatever, and we would use our imaginations. You know, the old argument is that television kills children's imaginations. It didn't kill ours. And, of course, I remember so fondly things like Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, which was just like heaven for me. And it still would be if I could see it now, I think.
Since you grew up watching TV and enjoyed a lot of the things that you watched, do you think that that's affected your approach as a television critic?
Yes, I don't remember television as replacing anything else in my life. I mean, I remember it's walking in, but I was never a radio child. I don't remember Jack Armstrong and the Lone Ranger and all of that, that people are always telling me I'm terribly deprived for not remembering that stuff, Inner Sanctum and all that. And although I lived in a small town, so going to the movies was quite an event, not something we did three times a week by any means. So television has been just a very integral part of my life all along, as far back as I can remember.
What would you say is your approach as a television critic? What do you feel your function is between the TV and your readers?
Well, to point them in the direction of something that's extraordinarily good or extraordinarily bad, because more than ever now, it's hard to know even what's on. People ask me what's on tonight. I say I haven't the slightest idea because, of course, I'm working 3 days in advance anyway. But there's tons of television with cable and all these other things flying through the air. So that, and then to kind of react to it and respond to it, hopefully with some kind of intelligence and with some kind of inside knowledge about why it is the way it is, other than just saying, you know, this stinks or this is magnificent. I don't really think much about the role of the critic, which I get asked about a lot, and I suppose maybe I should, but I think if I thought about it too much, I'd get very self-conscious and I wouldn't be able to do whatever it is I'm doing.
Do you enjoy watching things that are terrible that are on TV?
Yes, really excruciatingly terrible things. There was one movie this season. What was it called? Something about the perfume business. Bare Essence, that's it. A title that was meant to be misheard. It was very funny. It was like, you know, Valley of the Dolls and all that garbage. And I don't think that kind of trash is particularly harmful, you know, kept to certain limits. Dynasty, the regular weekly soap opera on ABC in prime time, is, you know, these people are leading such turbulent, tumultuous lives that it's really quite hilarious to see them falling off cliffs and into and out of affairs and finding babies under bushes or whatever it is they do on that show.
Could you explain what it is about things that are bad that are so much fun?
I don't know what it is. I usually bad television isn't quite as much fun as a bad movie for some reason. If it's really bad, if it's just mediocre, then I prefer television. Television has a finer finer fix on mediocrity, I think. I don't know. It's partly the fun of feeling superior to the material. The really discouraging television is that middle ground of just sort of you know, numb blank stuff where you can hear a machine laughing and you don't know why, and you're watching these plastic people tipple about, and it's all, it's not taking place on this planet, is it? I mean, it's just somewhere else. It has no relation to anything. Whereas a good, you know, gushy, trashy pot boiler, I think that's sort of basic to, I mean, it's like gossip. It's like overhearing good gossip. None of us can really resist it. We may think we're terribly intellectual and smart and chic and sophisticated, but we'll all fall for a good hunk of gossip about the people next door, the people in the office, blah, blah, blah. So I think trashy entertainment is like is the media equivalent of good gossip for people.
Do any of your colleagues at the Post or at National Public Radio watch the serials that you end up reviewing at the beginning of a season? Or do you find that there's very few people to talk to who actually watch the programs that are on TV?
At the newspaper, yes, to some extent, but I'd almost prefer that because I've always said that, you know, the film critic and the theater critic have great advantage, which is the managing editor does not, you know, walk them down the aisle of the theater and sit with them and watch the play. So if they come back and say this play is atrocious, then people sort of nod their heads and say, well, he must know what he's talking about. But if I come in the next morning after having recommended a show in the previous day's paper and the managing editor has watched it and hated it, he will, of course, let me know that and tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. You know, everyone is a television critic, so that makes it a little difficult sometimes to pull yourself up and say, wait a minute, you should listen to me.
Do you find that a lot of people don't really admit to watching what's on TV?
Yes, or they say they only watch public TV. And if they really do only watch public TV, I worry about their worldview. Not that it isn't worth watching often, but I think a constant diet would drive me right up the wall.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tom Shales, and he's the television critic for The Washington Post, film critic for National Public Radio, and a collection of his television columns from 1974 to 1982 has just been published under the title On the Air, and it's published by Summit Books. It seems that probably some of the people who are writing television programs now are baby boom generation people who grew up on television. Can you see that in any of the new programs coming out now?
I don't know. I don't know if I could think of an example of it, but I feel it as a tone or as an attitude, yes. I feel it in people like David Letterman, who really has no frame of reference outside of television and broadcasting, except sports. And what does he do? He sees that on television, too. And Sid Caesar was running around plugging his new book, and he said that he was up for a part in a show called Cheers, which happens to be a very good show, but he was offended that the writers didn't want him to contribute anything to the character they wanted him to play. And what he said was, here are these 25-year-old brats who grew up in Gilligan's Island trying to tell me, Sid Caesar, what is funny. And, of course, he does probably know better than they. So I think it does show up here and there on the air, and that's not terribly good for television, I guess, but what are you going to do? I mean, it's bound to happen. You know, the exciting thing about television in the 50s was that it attracted people from all these other fields who said, oh, look, what's this? Oh, you turn it on and you see a picture. Well, what could we do with that? Well, we could put a camera in a roller coaster, and they did things like that. Or we could do Macbeth in modern dress, and they did that, and we could write original play. I mean, they just kept trying to think of wonderful new ways to use it, and they often thought of great ones. Whereas now, all these people who've grown up with television, they're so aware of the limitations, they're like built into them. No one even has to tell them, no, you can't do that, because it's somehow they know it instinctively. So they don't try. They don't really try to stretch the medium, I'm afraid. And that may be why it's in such a doldrum right now.
Do you think that the content of any of the programs, especially, say, the family serials, are changing because they're written from the perspective of people who, say, went through the 60s and early 70s and tried to redefine the meaning of family and nuclear family and all this?
Yes, probably. I suppose if someone came on with I Remember Mama Now, it would be laughed right off the air. We, of course, all cried like babies when we saw it in the 50s. Yeah, you see that. And, of course, it's the obvious one is Family Ties, the show about two parents who went through the 60s and now have very conservative children, and that's on NBC.
Do you think television's doing the same job at kind of airbrushing real experiences, even though the experiences might seem like they're different? Do you think that they emerge the same as all the sitcom family serial experiences always have been?
Well, national television is, I mean, it's inevitably going to be a homogenizer, and in ways that are neither bad nor good, that just are. And of course it will tend to do that, to sort of, you know, polish the rough edges off of everything and make it palatable to a national mass audience. But Hill Street Blues did bring a kind of realism to television, which is too realistic for some people. And now it's been joined by St. Elsewhere, a very similar show. And both of these programs are fine and outstanding and beautifully written and directed and acted. But I think that that's enough now. I mean, I really don't think that the primetime network schedule could take too much of that kind of realism, because we have to face it. People tend to use television as an escapist machine, and it's hard to tell them that they should come home from a day at the office or the factory or standing on the corner, you know, directing traffic, and want to see programs about things that remind them of their lives and their problems and other than the news, and all of their frustrations. And so people who just think all of television is escapist piffle, well, it's escapist partly for a functional reason, I think. And I think the challenge is to be as, you know, as witty and clever and human as you can be within those kinds of limitations. A show like Taxi does that. You know, I wouldn't sit here and say this is the greatest dramatic emotional experience of my life when I watch Taxi each week, but it seems terribly valuable while you're watching it, even in a superficial way. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I know what you mean by that. But it must be odd for you to see what is your work as somebody else's escapism. So you have to, I guess, while you're working, try to figure out if it's good escapist fare or not. But of course, it can't be escapism for you because it's your job to seriously evaluate it.
That's true. How depressing. Well, it's the same with movies. If I really like them, I have to see them again, because the first time I've watched them, I have had to be thinking about things and writing things down and trying in my feeble way to analyze what I'm seeing. And that's not much fun. I mean, and then you go back and you see The Black Stallion a second time just to enjoy it.
What do you do for escapism, since you have to write seriously about movies and film?
I don't know. I never escape. I'm trapped. I'm absolutely trapped. I can go for real trash, you know, or, you know, the old movies they show on Saturday afternoons or something like that.
Satan's Cheerleaders.
Satan. Well, I wish they showed that on Saturday afternoons. No, more like Abbott and Costello in the Navy. I can relax with a good Abbott and Costello movie.
Tom Shales is my guest, if you're just joining us, in your essay on Happy Times? Good Times?
Good Times. Happy Days, Good
happy
Times.
Days, happy Days, okay.
They've used about all of those up now. Yes, right. Mediocre Afternoons or something will probably have before long.
You call Happy Days the counterfeit of the counterfeit family. Would you explain that for us? I thought that was really interesting.
Well, that in a way may be what you were talking about earlier, where people who'd grown up on television were now making television, because Happy Days never was a show about the 50s. It was a show about the way the 50s were portrayed in the 50s, really. So it was like, you know, an eighth carbon or something, you know, the Xerox machine when it gets low on toner or whatever they call that stuff. And it's just barely there at all. It doesn't pretend really to be authentic. Laverne and Shirley is the same way. I mean, it's arbitrarily, it's set in Milwaukee, or it was. Now it's set in Los Angeles, which is where all this stuff is actually filmed anyway. But nobody really expects anything authentic about that. Cheers is set in a Boston bar, but people don't come in and talk with a Boston accent. Shows set in the South, I mean, even Dallas, they don't really sound like they live in Texas, so... it's also arbitrary. It just all exists within a world called television, where the television people live. And Happy Days was just one of those shows. It started a whole trend of its own for the producer of it, Gary Marshall, who then spun off Laverne and Shirley and now Joni Loves Chachi and, you know, all of these really childish shows that Fred Silverman unleashed when he was at ABC. Which I think drove the median level of television down a bit.
Do you get angry when you see things like that aren't even trashy enough to be fun, aren't extravagantly trashy? Do you get angry that it's on, or do you just accept that television is this like really crazy parallel reality that doesn't have much to do with real life?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, I get frustrated that I can't appreciate it, because I like to think I'm I can appreciate anything that's good that's popular TV, not even if it's good, just if it's popular, that I could at least watch it and see what makes it popular. I guess in most cases I can do that. But to watch something that you find in absolutely no way diverting, I mean, that doesn't engage you in any way, even on the simplest level, is a little frightening, especially when you hear 230 people sitting in an audience, you know, laughing at it on a Hollywood soundstage, and then you think that, you know, 40 million others are sitting at home watching it, presumably laughing, or at least finding it that it occupies their minds. And that is a kind of gruesome feeling, yeah.
Do you ever try to compare your taste to the taste of either your readers or the American public, if one can generalize that much? Where does it come out when you do that?
I'm behind. they're ahead. well, yeah, I like to try and predict whether a show will succeed. Whether I like it or not is irrelevant. And I don't know what my batting average is. I thought that Beacon Hill would be a smash hit. You may not even remember that.
Do you?
Yeah. And of course, it was a dismal flop. But then I also said that Little House on the Prairie would run for years, and it did. And I said that Good Times, which is a show about a black family in Chicago, would run for years, and it did. It's still running in reruns. I never thought that The Love Boat would quite be the runaway smasheroo that it is. I said that it would, you know, hang around like Love American Style, which was a similar show many years ago. And so that sort of baffles me. The old Love Boat Fantasy Island 1-2 punch that ABC has on Saturday nights. I'd like to understand better why it is those programs are hits.
Well, Fantasy Island especially is such a campy program. It's hard to imagine seriously sitting down and you know, watching it seriously.
I know. Of course, now you can justify any of this stuff because you can just hope that SCTV will do a parody of it. You know, you can say, well, this is unendurable, but at least it gives fodder to those nutty people up in Canada who will do a wonderful spoof of this some Friday night.
Do you think that comedy has, like, made a comeback on television with SCTV and Saturday Night Live and David Letterman?
Yeah, especially in the fringe zones of television viewing. The mainstream sitcom stuff has actually gotten worse. And when you think that 10 years ago, CBS had All in the Family, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart, and several MASH and several other such shows all on the air every week. And now you look around for something of that caliber, you don't find it, which is too bad. Not so. But David Letterman I find absolutely hilarious, a little frightening in his limitations, the fact that he can't really converse with anyone, the fact that he isn't really interested in any of his guests. He had Frank Capra on the other night, and he did seem to feign a little interest in him, but a week earlier he had Hal Roach on. Now, this is a man who was around when the Keystone Cops were throwing – I mean, this is a man who's part of American history as much so as anything here in Philadelphia, a different kind of history, admittedly, but still part of our heritage, deserves respect. And David Letterman was like just totally unaware of him. He was totally unappreciative that he had this living history sitting next to him, which I just think he has a very limited experience. It's showbiz, and that's one thing I'm so sick of on television is the showbiz ethic, the showbiz milieu, talk about showbiz, you know, all the talk shows in which people come out and say, well, do you prefer the film to the stage, or would you rather be, you know, would you take off your clothes if the part demanded it and all of that stuff? I think America just gets inundated with all of this jibber-jabber about stuff that doesn't matter. Show business, you know, Las Vegas and all of those kind of twisted values out there. I sound like Jerry Falwell.
I saw David Letterman one night, and he was having on someone who was in, I even forget what the movie was, but he was also a young actor. It's his first film. And like Letterman's kind of variety comedy show is a kind of new kind, although I think it's somewhat similar to Steve Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And Letterman's the kind of person who I think would really spoof certain showbiz standards and certain talk show Carson-type standards, even though he's hosted Carson a lot.
Right.
So here comes this young actor who also, I'm sure, has spoofed all that a lot. But this actor actually has clips of his new film. And he looked at Letterman, and Letterman looked at him, and Letterman interviewed introduced the clip from his new film. And I felt really uncomfortable for both of them and for myself, because here were these people who would always spoof this, and suddenly they were in it. Suddenly they were doing exactly the same thing.
Well, the chips were down, and it was pay or play or something, I guess. Yeah, at least you don't see on that show a lot of this hugging and kissing and, oh, you were marvelous in your new movie. And I think Letterman hates that kind of phoniness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a new kind of showbiz phoniness that isn't as bad as the old kind. And that is refreshing.
Someone, I think it was Reuven Frank, who's the former president of NBC News, you quote him in one of your pieces as saying that what we have in TV news now is TV news for the blind. Would you explain what he was saying? Tell us if you agree with that.
Well, he was saying that that the picture doesn't come first anymore in TV news, that you don't go out and get a picture of something and then write a script to fit it. He says the way the reporters work now is they write a script and then they come back to the film library and they grab all these different pictures that'll fit into what they've already written. In other words, they've written a newspaper story, really, and then they just want to put pictures with it, which he thinks is absolutely wrong. And if you watch if you watch something like NBC News Overnight, occasionally they would tell a story in purely visual terms. Like one of the first flights of the space shuttle, they said, well, tape editor Joe Jones has put together this montage, blah, blah, blah. And they showed you like 3 minutes with no announcer standing up and nobody, you know, telling you what you were seeing. You just saw it, which is television. That's the idea. You're supposed to see things happening. And of course, now the whole philosophy of illustration on newscasts is, I find, baffling. I guess it comes from sports, where the picture, you know, where you're flooded with information, whether it's relevant or not, pasted up on the screen if possible. My best friend tried to get me to watch a football game the other night, and I sat there just dazzled by this torrent of information that comes. You know, a guy, the ball hits a man, and suddenly you know everything about this guy for the past 5 years. You know, how many kids he has, and no, I'm kidding now. But you know, the last time he received a pass successfully, how many? What's his record? The percentages, and the news is getting that way too. Flip, flip, flip. You know, it's just, and then, to me, that kind of visual razzle dazzle is numbing. It is not informing. And if you watch enough of it, you know, you're 20 minutes into the news and suddenly you realize you're like in a dream or something. You've just taken a Valium or something. Nothing is registered because it's just flying by so fast. I guess they're doing it for two reasons. One is they're afraid your attention will flag for just one instant, you know, and if you do that, what are you going to do? You're going to run up and turn to the other channel, right? That's what they think, which is, of course, baloney. People don't watch television that way. Even with remote control, which I have, you don't constantly, you know, make this tour of the channels. And their other feeling is just that they have to keep the picture changing no matter what. Oh, I know. They have the technological capacity now, so they do it. That's one thing. Technology does tend to lead people in television by the nose or whatever. And so the fact that they can now call up a videotape of, you know, Khrushchev stubbing his toe 25 years ago, like that, they will put it on the screen just so that you will see a different picture than the one you saw 10 seconds ago. I don't think this is getting us anywhere. It's probably they're going through this period now where they're just playing with all of this new technology to excess, and then maybe it'll die down again and we'll have a more sensible approach to the news. On the other hand, maybe it's going to just get faster and faster and faster, in which case, you know, the children who are growing up to television now, who are 4 years old and sitting there just staring at it, I don't know what they're going to be like in 20 years when they're running things. I'm not sure I want to be around.
I guess I
will be around, come to think of it.
I think it's funny to be in that position of wondering what the younger generation growing up on TV will be, since our parents wondered what we were going to
yes.
be like being the first generation to have TV.
Well, everybody thinks every new medium is the ruin of mankind. You know, I'm sure if we went back to the 17th century, whenever it was, the printing press, no. What century was the printing press? Well, it wasn't the 17th. Whenever it was. It was a long time ago. I'm sure there were people clucking about how, oh, the printing press, you know, what a disgrace. It's going to kill conversation and all of that.
If you had a TV station and could revive old shows and create some new ones, what would be on it?
Well, you know, in the Cube system in Columbus, they have one channel now that's only old television shows, which I think would be heaven for a while. Probably after 3 days you'd begin to... And of all things, the Christian Broadcasting Network, which is a satellite thing that relentlessly beams people praying and applauding for getting for praying, or that they applaud God or God takes a bow or something. I don't know. It's showbiz religion. But then at midnight Eastern time, that all stops and they start showing old black and white TV shows like Jack Benny, which is fun to see, and Burns and Allen, which was such a benign comedy show. I'm always struck by what a gentle show that was. And what a beguiling character Gracie was, really. I suppose feminists probably would object to her now. But she never had an unkind word for anyone, this character, or a malicious bone in her body, you know. And it's a very friendly comedy show. Very charming. So anyway, I'd probably revise that and The Honeymooners, which I think is practically a work of art, especially compared to today's sitcoms. When you think of how they restricted themselves to basically to one set and how rich the characterizations were. I mean, they were terribly broad. It kind of makes mincemeat of McLuhan's, you know, theory about cool personalities work best on television. You couldn't have been hotter than Gleason with those enormous pop eyes and those loud takes and, you know, those groans and rolling around and stuff. But I think that's priceless stuff. And a lot of those old shows are fun to watch just for the nostalgic value. Topper. One discovers now. Yes, it was quite terrible if you watch it now. And it has one of those...
Really?
Yeah.
I can't believe it's terrible.
It is. It's very slow, and there's a laugh track that sounds like it's coming in from Azusa or something. You know, it's one of those muffled kind of lulling ocean, like the ocean laugh tracks that seems totally irrelevant to what's happening on the screen. And it's shows like I Love Lucy, of course, are still playing everywhere.
What would you commission if you could create shows?
Well, I would want more live television of almost any kind. I would like to use the satellite capabilities to go to places just for the sake of going there. You know, to me, television, one of the basic ideas of television is you can sit in your home and be somewhere else, right? And what you usually get is you sit in your home and where are you? You're at Hollywood and you're at Sunset and Gower or something, you know. You're locked in a stupid room with a bunch of rather stupid people, apparently, who are laughing at even stupider people down on the stage. That's such a misuse of television, and that's what dominates it. But no, I would like, you know, they used to have a show called Wide, Wide World. And that's the one where they did put a camera in a roller coaster. And they said, now let's go to a rodeo in Wyoming. And, of course, you couldn't do that now. You'd say, now let's go to a missile silo in Wyoming or something. Or let's go to New Orleans for the Mardi Gras. And here's a camera, and let's plop it down and watch this. Maybe I'm naive or really out of it, but I would watch something like that because I like to see what's happening around the country. One thing I like about these satellite news channels is that they will pick up news reports that were done for local stations in, what, Albany or Tallahassee or, you know, Arizona or someplace. And it's just fun to see other parts of the country, to see something you're not familiar with, and there's a possibility you'll learn something from that. So I would have Wide, Wide World for real, because now it could be Wide, Wide World. It was really Wide, Wide Nation then. They didn't really have satellites to have live pickups from Europe and wherever. And that's sort of stuff. And I would like to see more purely visual television. Whenever the astronauts go up, I'm always so frustrated because on the evening news you get 30 seconds of these staggering pictures from outer space. And I know there must be more. You know, I would like there to be a channel. You know, there's a channel now where you can watch the House of Representatives in session, which can be edifying or can be stupefying depending on what they're doing. You know, it'd be nice to turn on a channel and be able to, when there's a space mission, to turn on a channel and be able to just watch the thing in real time. Maybe I'm being terribly impractical here, but I would watch something like that.
Do you think cable will make for interesting changes, or is already?
We all thought that, and then now everyone is saying cable's dead already. You know, things come and go so quickly here, as they said in the Land of Oz. Cable's in a bad way right now. It's financially, the bubble has burst. People are discovering it isn't a money printing machine. And on the other hand, then you had things like CBS cable failing, which is another kind of disappointment for those of us who thought, cable, it's going to be something for everyone. You know, all of these minority tastes will be served. People who don't want to watch Chachi and Joni and, you know, all of those people will have something else. And really, all cable serves up now is Australian football games at 2 o'clock in the morning for people who wanted that all these years. I don't know who those people are. Was there a great call for that? I don't know. And movies on pay channels like HBO and Showtime and the Movie Channel. And that's not really much of a millennium, is it? It's a washout.
You have cable at home?
Yes. I, in fact, moved to Arlington, Virginia, which is across the Potomac River from actually the District of Columbia, partly to get cable TV because they don't have it in D.C. yet, and they're just getting it in the Maryland suburbs. So I like to be able to see what's available, and not much is, actually.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. In case you don't recognize the voice of my guest, he's Tom Shales, who's National Public Radio's film critic. You can hear him regularly on Morning Edition from 6 until 8, that's broadcast. And he's also the television critic for The Washington Post. That column is syndicated, and in Philadelphia it's carried in the Daily News. And a new collection of his columns from The Washington Post has just been published, and the title of that collection is On the Air, and it's published by Summit Books. Let's talk about film. How did you get your film education? Was it in the movie theaters?
Yeah, as a kid, and then taking film courses in college. I went to the American University in Washington, where we had a pretty good film teacher. And that's where I saw Potemkin and The Seventh Seal and all that other stuff everybody has to see as part of their growing up in movies.
Do you remember what it was like when you started to realize, or maybe you always realized, what kind of went behind the making of a movie and how many different layers there might be in a sequence, both visual and in
a... I've never realized that, actually. I'm still totally mystified by the whole thing. I find it quite amazing. No, it's funny. You can know the tricks and still be... that's the wonderful thing about the movies, and you still walk in there and you can be bowled over. I remember I was on a soundstage in Hollywood once poking around, and they were doing the remake of King Kong, and they were testing this big arm that was on a... what do you call it? It was like a tractor, but at the end of it was this arm of an ape, and they were making it move, and that, you know, the hand closed, and this was just intoxicatingly magical to me. Of course, then when you saw the movie, it wasn't magical at all. So I'm not sure what that story proves, except that sometimes it doesn't translate onto the silver screen.
Do you usually see movies you like several times?
Yes. You know, one movie, you mentioned layers, one movie that that hardly exists at all is Citizen Kane. You know, Pauline Kael has written that virtually every shot is a fake in that movie. Not virtually every shot, but most shots, you know. They were done with various processes and stuff like that. But when I see it, or King Kong, another RKO picture, the original now, I still find it totally convincing. I'm still able to suspend my disbelief completely. Knowing how it's done doesn't seem to hurt. I've met film directors who say they never watch a movie more than once, and it's for them it's nothing, which I think is kind of sad. It's something you lose, I guess, when you become a film director. You gain the artistic power and all of that, but you lose the ability to be knocked for a loop by the movies.
Which movies have you seen the most times?
Well, probably The Wizard of Oz, because it's on television every year and has been for, I think, 27 years now. I don't know. I've seen Singing in the Rain about 15 times. I mean, obviously these would be pleasurable films that I would see over and over. Citizen Kane I never get tired of. Citizen Kane I've seen so many times that now I start to, you know, you start to looking at it in terms of how is the print. And you're seeing things like, oh, look, over in that corner, you can see something you didn't see the last time. And you know where the spices come. I mean, you know where the real changes are. And Mighty Joe Young I've seen a great many times. And would see right this minute if it were available.
Actually, I saw it 2 weeks ago on TV. And
Really?
Growing up in New York, I used to watch Million Dollar Movie, where movies would play all day and all night, all week, one movie. So I just thought, you know, that I knew all the dialogue of Mighty Joe Young by heart. In fact, I hardly remembered any of the sequences. And it turned out to be one of the stupidest looking films I'd ever seen. And I was really surprised.
It's kitsch to the nth degree. But you mentioned Million Dollar Movie, and you talked before about people growing up on television. I remember a friend of mine, I played him a piece of music once that went, dum, dum, da, dum. And I said, of course, you know what that is, don't you? And he said, why, yes, it's the theme from Million Dollar Movie. I said, you idiot. It's Gone with the Wind. It's one of the most famous. He didn't know that was the theme from Gone with the Wind. Oh, well.
Who were the film critics that you read before you started writing?
Well, Pauline Kael, who I read and still do read. Andrew Saris, I used to read, but don't anymore. Gary Arnold, who writes for the Washington Post, is a kind of Pauline Kael protege, and I think he's absolutely brilliant. I think he's the best guy writing for a daily newspaper on film in the country. Very underappreciated, partly because he doesn't gush and, you know, award movies stars or anything like that. He just analyzes them, and he's terribly realistic about it all. And who else is there? I don't know. Film critics. I used to read Stanley Kaufman. Don't anymore. He got kind of stodgy and irrelevant. There don't seem to be as many as there used to be, do there?
Did you try to write like anyone who you had read? Was anyone especially inspirational to you?
No. I think over the years, I could go back and this would be a very boring thing to do, but I could do it. I could go back and find that I'd been influenced at some point by a number of people, but then you put it all together and you eventually have your own style. And all these, you know, Johnny Carson is the ultimate synthesis of, I'm not comparing myself to Johnny Carson, but it's that sort of thing. You know, you can see that he's borrowed this and borrowed that and borrowed this, and yet Johnny Carson has his own identity. I don't think I borrowed anything, but I think unconsciously I probably was influenced by people like Pauline Kael. I'm sure she wouldn't want to hear that, but I was.
When did you realize that you were going to be, or that you wanted to be a critic, and that's how you wanted to use your writing on a kind of daily, weekly basis?
Well, I never did. I mean, I wanted to be a writer, and I'm very suspicious of people who want to be critics. I think it's a perfectly honorable profession, but I think it's a dishonorable thing to want to be one. Because people who want to be them usually dream of it in terms of power and glory and influence. And I've never thought in terms of wielding power with this. And in fact, a television critic doesn't wield much power. I mean, you have certain readers who will read you and trust you, but they're not going to affect the Nielsen ratings. 1 point, probably. And the most you can do is intimidate network executives, which is fun to do. And people like Rune Arledge, who's very, very intimidatable and gets very excited whenever you say anything negative. So that keeps life semi-interesting. But I don't believe in aspiring to be a critic. I think, on the other hand, I don't think it's good that a lot of TV critics are failed something else's. I don't think of myself as a failed something else. I think I just sort of wandered more or less naturally into the field. But I think a lot of TV critics set out to be drama critics or film critics, and then they were handed television and they think of it as a lowly assignment. I personally think it's the most important of all, so it doesn't bother me. I don't feel inferior in terms of anything to a movie critic or a drama critic.
Why do you think television is more important than film, for instance?
Because it influences so many more people and in so many more ways. I mean, the way we speak, the way we dress, so many frames of reference that we all share, we get from television. And movies have a more specific kind of impact, and of course they influence television a lot because last year's hit movie is always this year's would-be hit television show. But we're a television-saturated culture. I don't think there's any comparison. Movie going, of course, has dropped precipitously since the 40s when movies were it, and now it's television. That's the simple truth of it.
Do you write novels or stories or anything like that in your...
Absolutely not. And it's like you walk down the street now and people say, write a novel. You know, everyone's coming at you to write a novel. What is this great compulsion to write a novel? Like you can't leave this planet without having written a novel? Is it a requirement to get into the hereafter or something? They say, well, yes, but where's your novel? We don't see a novel here. You'll have to go back and start over. No, I don't want to write a novel. I guess I'm being too adamant about that. People aren't really begging me to do it.
Oh, he really wants to write a novel. That's what people would be thinking.
Huh? Yes, right. He's a closet novelist, and he won't admit it.
There's just so many journalists now who actually have novels that they're working on at night at home.
I know. I don't think a week goes by that somebody doesn't say, you know, you can make a novel out of that. You know, if you sneeze, they say you could make a novel out of it. I think there are too many novels. There's too many books.
You were, I think, the editor of your high school paper?
Yes, I'm afraid so, yeah.
Did you save any of them, and do you ever read it?
Yes. A friend and I used to do a humor column, sort of. which we found just to be hysterically funny. And I'm not sure I ever laughed as hard in my life since then, as we did then, writing those things that nobody got. The parents of all the kids used to read them and find them very funny. I guess we were ahead of our time in some way. And that was a lot of fun. When you did it for fun, it was really great. When you do it for money, it's never quite the same.
When you read the stuff that you wrote in high school, is it still funny to you? Are you ever...
Some of it is, you know, mortifying. The serious stuff I wrote is just obnoxious, you know, in the extreme. And I think I should have been spanked. In fact, was called to the principal's office every now and then. I was
for your writing?
Yes. Oh, I was the most messianic newspaper editor. I mean, I had all these dreams of... And this was before Woodward and Bernstein. I mean, long before Watergate or anything like that. I had these visions of being a great crusader, and we would go off on tangents on the slightest whim, and it would get us in all kinds of trouble.
Like what?
Oh, we would hear a rumor that somebody was being discriminated against by a certain organization, and I would rush to the printed page, you know, denouncing them without ever checking it out. And then we would get called down, and we would be told that, in fact, this was total poppycock, and we would go back to our offices red-faced and do something crazy the next week.
Have you ever considered, burning or otherwise disposing with the articles from your past that embarrass you when you read them now?
Not really. They're like baby pictures. I mean, they're embarrassing, but no one would, no. I'm sure there are many pieces I would like to burn. I mean, many that I've written for the Post. I don't, you know, putting this book together was not fun at all, because you go back and look at your old stuff and you think, oh my God, you know, this is absolute garbage. And then you'll get to a piece and you'll say, oh, this isn't bad. But then the ratio, just like the ratio of good television to bad, the ratio is bound to be against you when you write for a daily newspaper. You just cannot. Unless you're H.L. Mencken. And who knows? I mean, maybe if we went back and went through all of Mencken's stuff, we would find a lot of real terrible clinkers in there. I'm not comparing myself to Mencken, by the way. But that was a very unpleasant experience.
Which seems more ephemeral to you, radio or newspapers, since they're both gone pretty quickly?
I guess radio. We're still very print oriented, and I find the people I write about in broadcasting have much more awe than I do for the printed word. I mean, they are just so intimidated by it. And when they have, I always say, "Well, you've got all the power, and you've got all the..." But something about print, you know, it's still hanging in there. We still have a smattering of the old print culture left, and probably will till the end of the century or so. So, I guess radio is more. More ephemeral, yeah. But I love it when people will come in and they'll say, "Well, you said something funny this morning on the radio, and I almost drove off the road from laughing." To me, that is the highest praise. I'd rather they said that than that you were terribly profound this morning. Since I never am terribly profound, that's probably why I think that way.
There's some people who know you most through your writing and others who know you most through your radio work. Do they think of you as being two different people? You know, like the people who hear your voice imagine you being a different kind of person than the person reading you would?
Well, when they meet me, they think of me as having been a very tall, thin, macho person, which, of course, I am. sometimes they'll say, "Are you the same Tom Shales?" And since it's such an uncommon name, I always wonder why they would think that there were two of them running around. No, usually they seem to make that connection, if they're interested.
Do the print people visualize you differently than the radio people do?
Oh, I don't know. I do get incredibly violently angry mail at the Post, and sometimes they do make certain assumptions about you, that you're of your race or your political orientation. You know, they call you a flaming liberal or something like that, and you know deep in your heart you're not any such thing, but you don't bother to write back because people like that have their minds pretty well made up. Yeah, if you put distinguished colleague Mr. Carmody, Jack Carmody, who works with me at the Post, is very conservative politically, and he got a letter yesterday accusing him of being a flaming, wide-eyed, you know, liberal, and he just wonders what he's written to instill that kind of reaction. The thing is, of course, that you never can control it, and you never can make yourself clear to everyone. I wrote a piece about when Ingrid Bergman was alive. I interviewed her and did a long sort of feature interview with her for the Post, and I got letters saying, "How could you be so cruel to Ingrid Bergman?" and letters saying, you pushover, you know, that love letter to Ingrid Bergman, what a piece of mush. So eventually you just have to ignore it all, I guess, except what your mother says. That's what you always have to listen to what your mother says.
Since one of the fears that people have had since TV and radio were invented, it was that it would make you possibly antisocial, that you'd withdraw from people. Since your job is to monitor what's on movies and TV, do you think it's affected you in any way?
Yes, adversely. I do have, but I'm not sure which came first. I mean, maybe I was antisocial, so I gravitated to television. I'm not sure that television turned me in any particular direction that way. I tend to be a rather solitary person, so I suppose I'm the ideal TV critic, assuming I have the other credentials in order. It doesn't bother me to stay at home for hours on end watching television. Sounds terribly sad as I sit here and talk about it, but it really doesn't. And you know, when these long things come around, like what was the last big long one? Oh, The Blue and the Gray. I just took the damn thing home, a stack of like 8 cassettes, 1 hour each, and I sat there all day and watched it in one day. Most people, you know, it's shown on the air in 3 nights, but I just like to get them over with and do it like that. And that does not bother me at all. I don't get fidgety or restless. I do tend to eat while I'm doing that, which is a big problem that is of no interest to anyone. But other than that, I'm not sure. I have often said I will leave my brain to the Smithsonian or John Hopkins or something, and they can see how much damage television did to it, assuming they know what shape it was in to begin with.
Were you ever discouraged when you were young and developing your interest in television from watching it?
No. In fact, I saved the only discouragement was I saved TV guides. Something strange in the back of my mind told me that these would be interesting artifacts someday. And indeed they would have been, except my mother threw them all away, thinking they were worthless. Not only would they be interesting, they'd be worth a lot of money today if I still had them. Of course, I'll never let her forget that. But no, I wrote about television. I still find I'm a saver, a fanatical saver, and I have old papers, term papers and things from junior high school even, in which I wrote about television. There's some sort of natural affinity there, I guess. And I wrote things like, it'll never get worse, it couldn't get worse, and those are words I would have to eat today since it did. But I don't know why, but I've been stuck on it.
So since you survived the TV experience intact, do you ever worry about the younger generation watching lots of TV? You know, do you think that, you know, like parents should control or try to control their children's viewing habits?
Yes, I think they should limit it.
You really do?
Yeah, I really do. And it's not that I think it makes people violent or dumb or, I don't know, randy or anything like that. I think it can be numbing, though. And I really think that's why we have heavy metal rock. Because I think these kids who are brought up in television, I think it's why we have heavy metal rock, and I think it's why we have movies like Friday the 13th. They're starved for stimulation, even sensory stimulation. And so they go out and they have music that absolutely beats their brains in, and they have movies in which, you know, hideous, monstrous acts occur on the screen to which they're really rather indifferent. I mean, they may scream or may laugh, actually. And I think all of those kinds of phenomena are traceable to television, because it almost never really reaches that high, you know, unless it's a time of great national trauma. I mean, if you were alive during the Kennedy assassination, the John Kennedy assassination, you will never forget it as you experienced it on television, and it was. High-level trauma, almost the highest level one could have, other than, you know, if it were a member of your own family and you were having the experience for real. But most of the time, television experience is a sort of mid-range experience. It seems to occupy only a small spectrum of I don't know, emotional latitude and certainly intellectual.
We were talking before about the ephemeral nature of newspapers and radio shows, and now you've got a collection of columns from 1974 to 1982 in your new book. Does that feel good to you to have that collected? And you could have this book and have all these years of your work or the what you consider to be the best of those years of your work gathered together, sitting in one part of the shelf?
No, it doesn't feel very good. And it's not really what I consider the best anyway, you know, because when you write a book, you're you sell your soul to the devil, and then the devil tells you what's going in the book. And the devil says the cover has to look like a carnival, and the devil says this and that. And the devil in this case is Summit Books, those awful people in New York. But every author, and I call myself an author, which is stretching the term since the book is a collection, but every author hates his publisher, I've discovered. And every publisher has a terrible reputation. Every single one.
Well, we're out of time. I've enjoyed this hour very much, and I've enjoyed your reviews ever since you've been on NPR. So glad you're able to be with us today. Thanks so much, really.
It was great fun for me. Thank you.
Tom Shales has been my guest, and he's been National Public Radio's film critic for several years now. He's also the TV editor and TV columnist with The Washington Post. It's a syndicated column, and in Philadelphia it's frequently in the Daily News. And there's a collection of his TV columns, selected TV columns from 1974 to 1982. The name of this new collection is On the Air, and it's published by the aforementioned Summit Books. And thanks so much again for being with us. It's a minute to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Well, I guess I should mention that Tom Shales' reviews on NPR are heard on Morning Edition, and we carry that from 6 until 8 every morning. Well, tomorrow's Thanksgiving Day, and as our special holiday edition of Fresh Air, we'll be featuring the 5th anniversary celebration of Jazz Alive, and we'll be featuring 3 hours of some of the highlights of Jazz Alive's history. And performers will include Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald, many others. I can't even remember offhand, but it's five years of highlights, and it's a very exciting show. So that's tomorrow from 2 until 5 on Fresh Air. Ken Tucker contributed to today's program, and Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller is the associate producer of the show. Ron Carson has been the technical director. My name's Terry Gross, and I wish you a very good evening and a great Thanksgiving and a great four-day weekend if you're lucky enough to get one. Thanks for listening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from News and Information Fund.